Alltså. So this afternoon I'd like to turn the meditation again to the Avalokiteshvara sadhana. A couple of comments before we start. I've emphasized that as we approach this as a state regeneration practice, including the divine pride and all of this, that it's indispensable to have some insight into emptiness, emptiness of the self, emptiness of individual, as well as phenomena. And that's certainly true. I think it's really not even debatable. I won't debate it. It's too obvious to debate. On the one hand. On the other hand, you know, I have lived with Tibetans for years in Dharamsala, for example. Been to Tibet a number of times. And most Tibetans don't have a clue what Madhyamaka is. You know, they haven't studied. I mean, most Tibetans are Buddhist, but the nomads out there watching their yaks, the farmers, the merchants, and the so forth and so on, they've probably heard the term Madhyamaka, but that's it. But many of them, and I think it's still true today, things are complex under the Chinese domination, communist domination, or about 100 years ago, the vast majority had faith in the Buddha Dharma. A lot of them had very deep faith, not much understanding, you know, but a lot of faith. And so there are many, many stories, and I simply have no choice but to take them seriously. I just can't think that all of Tibetan culture was a conspiracy designed to confuse people like me. You know, I think they really had better things to do, you know. And so there are many stories. If you know, those of you who have been with Tibetans for some, you must have heard them. But people, very simple people, nomads, farmers, and so forth, uneducated, not even literate, but having very strong faith, making prayers to Tara, having visions of Tara, getting blessings of Tara. If you look into the teachings on Tara, you'll find, you know, she's the Tara, she's the savioress, she's the Tara. And many people have received, have visions, but also what normal people would probably simply call miracles, you know, miraculous healing and so forth. That they attribute to Tara, and for them it's straightforward. I saw her, there was this blessing, it was a miracle, and something marvelous happened that simply cannot be understood in mundane terms, right? The same thing, of course, is true for Avalokiteshvara. Same, there are two sides of the same coin, male and female manifestation of enlightened compassion. It's the same thing. I mean, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, you know, all over the country. And people reciting this, people without deep insight, getting benefits, getting blessings, sometimes having visions and so forth. So without the insight, is this a stage of generation practice? Not really. But can you receive blessings from it, benefit from it? Can that be of benefit to you in this lifetime and in future lifetimes? Absolutely, yes. But it's all really is a matter of your faith. Do you have the faith, the reverence, the devotion? Is that there or not? If it is, then the door's open. Whereas in contrast, this isn't often said, but I think it's true, and that is, one may be a super smart geshe who can trample other people in debate and grind them into the ground and, you know, be able to give brilliant scintillating lectures on Madhyamaka and really not have much faith. And if such a person practices Avalokiteshvara Tara, they will know, well, it's empty of inherent nature, I'm empty of inherent nature, nothing much happens. It's intellectual, it's basically a light show. And if they don't really meditate on emptiness, then, as they say, the emptiness is all in your mouth. Katsam matayomari. Roya. It's just in your mouth. So, and it's happened. It's happened very sadly, and I'm obviously not going to give any examples, but there are sadly some. I know of one. Very good teacher, really smart, really articulate. Gotten the whole education. Could teach debating inside and out. And a big benefactor came to, you know, support the Sangha there, and he stole the money. He stole the money that was given to the Sangha to give to his own family, and he took off, you know. There he was, you think, whoa, and then, whoa. He is so smart and hadn't figured out the four basic root downfalls of a monk, and if you commit one of those, you are toast. You're really toast, you know. He hadn't figured that one out, but boy, he could talk up a storm when it came to Madhyamaka. So if you're going to err on one side or the other, err on the side of faith, rather than being a smart aleck. No. So, and if you can put the two together, with method and wisdom, well then, we've heard about that many times. So this is being presented because this is not simply to receive blessings and so forth. This is actually part of a path right there, you know, to achieve enlightenment even in this lifetime. For that, of course, then both are necessary. The faith is necessary. The insight into emptiness is necessary. But let's linger just a moment to see exactly what is being refuted. This series, I mean, it's very opportune, the timing is very nice because His Holiness suggested I translate this series of essays. And the one I'm translating right now is really quite brilliant. The essence of it is all that the fundamental view of the Majjhimaka, middle way view of Nagarjuna, by way of Chantakirti and on into Tibet, the Majjhimaka, the Mahamudra, and the Dzogchen, they're all converging on the same view. They're completely compatible with each other. And it's about a 30-page essay. I'm pretty close to finish with it. And he just hammers it in, and he's just citing the big ones, Longchen Rabjamba, Tsongkhapa, Karsa, just a couple of others. And then, of course, the great Indians, the Nagarjuna, the Chantakirti, and so forth. Rongzoma, Pandita, one of the great ones in the Nyingma tradition. But what really came out as I'm just translating this, you really learn, you kind of get very intimate with the text when you translate it, because you have to know every single syllable, and you have to try to understand every single syllable, because you have to translate every single syllable. The point that really came out clearly for me, kind of leapt out as I was doing the translation, is where there's complete agreement in the Dzogchen, the Majjhimaka, and of course the Mahamudra is just no different, and that is what's not being refuted are Nang Sam, the mere appearances, that we're not refuting. We're not touching it, basically. We're just saying, but you can leave it. The mere appearances, yes. But then we have these mere appearances, and then the conceptual mind comes into play, and it turns mere appearances into a world of this's and that's's, of objects and subjects and people and places and physical worlds and so forth. The mere appearances, one appearance doesn't have another appearance. They don't own each other. They're just what they are. What you see is what you get. It's just an appearance. When you look at the reflection in a mirror, that's all there is to it. There's nothing more to it. It doesn't belong to anything. It is just what it appears. That's it, nothing more. And that goes for, you know, the 10 illusions. So we can say this, I think, with a lot of confidence, and that is obviously couching this in a Buddhist worldview. The appearances that rise up to meet us, that come by way of the six sense doors, from moment to moment, year to year, lifetime to lifetime, this is what's being dished up by our karma. In short, that's what you're getting from karma. Nobody's doing it to us, not God or some great big mindless machine or bad people or what have you. The appearances are coming up. We sowed the seeds for them, and now they're manifesting. But when I say I sowed the seeds of the karma that's manifesting now in some past life, that person in the past life was not Alan Wallace. So it's not that simple. I mean, there's no Alan Wallace that gets plunked down from lifetime to lifetime. So even there, it's, there's a continuity. So without elaborating on that, the appearances themselves are just appearances. They're just empty appearances. And they're coming as the fruition. This is the harvest. This is the harvest. What's manifesting. What sense I make of these appearances, as I conceive of myself, the people, what kind of people are there around me, what kind of environment are there around me, that's not karma. I'm doing that right now. That's not karma. That's not forced on me. That's not my destiny. That's not past lives. How I'm conceptually designating things right now, I'm doing that right now. Nobody else is doing it. It's not past karma, which means I've got choice. That is, the appearances don't demand designate me this way, designate me that way. They're just appearances. They don't even talk. They're just colors in the palette. They're just colors in the palette. But the world, the story that we write, the world that we literally do conceive, that we're doing by the power of our conceptual designation, we're writing the story. And we can keep on rewriting the story. We're not locked into one script, right? The story, of course, is empty because we made it up. the appearances are empty, and on top of appearances, we project a story, and then out of delusion, we take the story to be real. That's a problem. But when we see that, all right, number one, it's not real, because you investigate it, you see it doesn't exist from its own side. And number two, you see it is merely conceptually designated, which means I can stop. And I take one step back. So I take a step back from the delusion of reification, take another step back from simply objectifying and creating a world of a whole bunch of objects and subjects, and just come back and rest in mere appearances arising through all the six sense doors. You see, you still have one more arrow in your quiver. You still have one more choice you can make if you choose, but you need to know that you have that choice to make. Again, a choice that we can make that we don't even know that we have is then not a choice, right? You have to know you can make a choice in order to make the choice. And so even that's a choice. Even the appearances that are arising, even there's a choice, let alone how we objectify them, what story we make up. Because bear in mind, whatever story you have about yourself, you made it up. There can be no question about that. And of course, other people have their stories about you. And I'll tell you something, their story is not the same as your story. Never. Everybody's got their story. And of course, there are false stories, stories that are made up out of the blue with no basis of designation of any appearances except for, I kind of thought that was the case. You know, that's fantasy. So there is still, even within stories, there is a possibility of simply making a mistake. It happens in science, and then good science corrects that, but it's still a story. The scientific story, the Kalachakra story, the Shravakayana story, and so forth. But coming back to mere appearances, nang sam, empty appearances, nang wa tongba, even there's a choice. And that is, if we develop our skill set, having identified these are called matape nangwa, impure appearances. And they're being generated by karma and klesha. Karma and klesha. And this is what we're getting. This is the harvest of our past karma and klesha. And so that's what's being dished up. These are, if we're playing poker in this cosmic field, these are the cards that were dealt. But then how you play them, whether you're a smart poker player or a stupid poker player, well, it's up to you. Those are just the cards. But then, even here, even if you take a step further back, there's still a more fundamental choice in this, and that is, I don't want to play poker. That's a choice. Nobody told you have to play poker. Yes, you are sitting at the table. Yes, you have your chips. Yes, you have. But you don't have to play poker. You can just say, I fold. You know how you do that? Om svabhavishuddha savadama svabhavishuddhoham. I fold. That's what you just did. Hello, samsara. I fold. I don't want to play this game. I'm not going to operate according to your rules. I'm not going to follow a causal vehicle. I'm not going to continue taking seriously that I'm a sentient being and I have to deal with all the karmic crap that comes up from now until enlightenment. I just learned that I don't have to play this game because the game itself is a construct and I decide I want to deconstruct it. Now, Om Svabhavishuddha Savadama Svabhavishuddhoham. All phenomena are empty of inherent nature. I am that empty nature. I am Dharmakaya. I am the purity of all phenomena. That's not simply a simple negation. No, because you need more to practice Vata. You need more than understanding emptiness. You need to have that intuitive affirmation of Dharmakaya. No Dharmakaya, no Vajrayana. That's the way that is. So, if you wish, you say, I hear all these appearances, all these impure appearances from my impure negative karma, positive karma, but basically all saturated by karma and klesha. Hear all these appearances arising. They're all empty. So I've already deconstructed that tangible physical world out there and the tangible subjective world in here. I've dissolved that into just a ray of appearances arising in this process, this ongoing matrix of dependent origination, giving an incredibly good imitation of being a real physical world, like a very vivid dream. It's a great imitation. That's why it's so tricky. That's why we remain non-lucid. But you're all left with that, and then as an act, as a decision, you just suddenly wake up and say, this is a decision I can make, I'm going to make it. Hello, appearances. Dissolve them away. Turn off the machine. Dissolve them all into emptiness. The emptiness that is indivisible from Dharmakaya. Dissolve them all. No impure appearances. Just say, I fold. And so everything's just gone. You're gone, your body gone, your mind gone, the entire phenomenal world around you all gone. Thank you. I fold. Whew. It's really like that. I mean, just, I have to come back to my little Macintosh. You know, when you take something off the table, like that. It's gone. And then, like Skype coming on. Computer zombie here. You know, but what's happening here is lungidupa, and that is out of that luminous emptiness, that Dharma Dhatu pervaded by Dharmakaya spontaneously emerges. Lungidupa is spontaneously actualized, the seed syllable. Right? And then the show goes on. But you've simply decided as an act of will, I would rather be operating from the platform of pure appearances rather than impure appearances. And I choose to do so, since reality does not demand otherwise. So what you're doing here as an act of volition is you're saying, I know perfectly well what the world of actuality is. I'm not delusional. I'm not crazy. I don't think that Alan Wallace is a Buddha or has four arms and so forth. No, I got that one. That's simply this array of impure appearances with the corresponding conceptual designations, all empty, subjectively, objectively. I'm going to dissolve all of that. And I'm going to move from this realm of actuality into a realm of possibility, and that too is as real as anything else. Because the realm of actuality does not inherently exist. It's not really there from its own side. Possibilities do exist. Who can say that possibilities don't exist? It's crazy. If possibilities didn't exist, then the world would never change, because nothing would be possible that's not already actual. So possibilities exist as much as anything else. It has to be true, isn't it? Possibilities exist as much as a mountain or an atom or a galaxy. Possibilities exist. That's really evident. If you want to go into physics, well, just check out quantum mechanics. It's all about possibilities. And so I'm simply choosing for the time being, as I go into the sadhana, to dissolve this particular world of actuality, which is completely empty of inherent nature. I'm going to dissolve it right back into the ground, Dharma Dhatu, indivisible from Dharmakaya. And I'm going to now rise in this virtual reality, venturing into the realm of possibility. And I'm going to rise at the seed syllable, arise with the sacred identity of being Avalokiteshvara, and so on. And that's going to be my platform. And if this is done with insight and with faith, devotion, reference, a true sense of the sacred, then you get all the benefits. All the benefits. And then you can turn this into a shamatha practice. So when lamas, I know like Lama Zubar Rinpoche and others, and many, many Gelupa lamas, and many others as well, Gelupas have no monopoly on this, they say, well, if you're going to practice shamatha, well, then why not do the supercharged shamatha? You know, the super duper macho, or Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, kind of shamatha that comes fully charged with every, you know, all the, like a Mercedes that's loaded, like, you know, it has all the perks. Why not, if you're going to practice shamatha, why not do it totally within the context of stage regeneration? And then it's immensely more powerful than just doing it in a sutrayana context. Good. All right. You just have to do your checklist. Bodhicitta? Yeah, check. No problem. Realization of emptiness? Check. No problem. Non-neurotic mind? Oh, yeah. For sure. Yeah, check. You can visualize for sustained periods without wrapping yourself up in a knot. Yeah, no problem. Very deep guru devotion, guru yoga. Yeah, impeccable, no problem there either. Okay, then good, go for it. If the checklist didn't quite work out, then you might want to find something, a shoe that, you know, fits your feet, rather than walking around in size 15 shoes when you're wearing your little ballerina, you know. Olaso. So, for this session, if you can be sitting comfortably, that would be better. If you cannot for 24 minutes be sitting comfortably, then you have my invitation. Find a more comfortable position. Having settled your body, speech, and mind in the natural state, take refuge and arouse bodhicitta. As Kamachamir writes, bring forth the aspiration for supreme enlightenment. Then withdraw all conceptual designations of objects out there and subjects in here. As you rest your awareness in its natural state, still, inactive, not conceptually designating, but simply being aware of the mere appearances arising through the six sense doors, all of them empty, none of them existing from their own side. And then if you already had very deep samadhi, you literally could withdraw your awareness from them. Withdraw your awareness into the substrate, into an empty field. Even without such deep samadhi, you can imagine it. Imagine all these appearances shimmering, fading, disappearing into empty space, vast, open, empty and luminous. And the Sanskrit is Om Svabhavashuddha Savadama, Svabhavashuddho Ham. Optimally, you'd be resting right now in Rigpa, non-dually aware of the Dhamma Dhatu. And out of this open space, imagine your consciousness as the white syllable Hri, rays of light are emitted, purifying the vices and obscurations of all sentient beings. This is your virtual reality. Do with it what you will. The outer universe is a palace, and its inhabitants are deities. So by the power of imagination, you look upon your entire environment with pure vision, as if from the perspective of pristine awareness, your best approximation. The light rays are withdrawn and dissolve into the three. Upon a lotus sun and moon seat, the syllable three melts into light, which transforms into yourself as the great compassionate one. The color of your body is white, and you have one face. Like a blossoming lotus, you are smiling radiantly. The braids of your locks are bound up, adorned with a crown of five precious substances and a silken diadem. The first of your four hands are pressed together at your heart. The lower right holds a pearl rosary, and the lower left holds a lotus. You are beautifully adorned with a throat ornament, a collar band, necklace, and semi-necklace of various precious substances. You are luminous with no outer or inner obscurations. You are seated with both legs crossed. Various rays of light shine out. That is the nature of the Samayasattva. Upon a moon disc at your heart, the six syllables circle clockwise around a white syllable, hri, That is the Samadhi Sattva. By the power of verbally reciting Om Mani Padme Hum, all the Sugatas of the three times become of the nature of the Great Compassionate One and dissolve into you like raindrops. That is the fully perfected Jnana Sattva. The whole universe and all its inhabitants become the deity. Phenomena are the presentation of the divine body. All sounds and voices are the six syllables. Sounds are the presentation of the divine speech. The mind is the self-arisen union, and memories and thoughts are the presentation of the divine mind. So as we chant together the mantra, as we did before, imagine rays of light flowing forth from your heart, from this each syllable and the surrounding six syllables in all directions, inviting, invoking the Buddhas of the three times, who converge in upon you in the form of Avalokiteshvara, and dissolve into your body, speech, and mind indivisibly. As you view the surrounding environment and all those who inhabit it with pure vision, all forms as Namanakaya, all sounds as Sambhogakaya, and all thoughts and mental events as expressions, creative expressions of Dharmakaya. Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 Om mani padme mani padme hum. Om 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 mani padme hum. Mani padme hum. Om mani padme hum. Om mani padme hum. Om mani padme now in this sacred space, with this sacred embodiment and this sacred identity, let's move to the practice of shamatha. And we have two ways to go. You may simply rest in this awareness, illuminated from within, of the surrounding environment, the lotus, moon, and sun disk, your own form. The moon at your heart, the central syllable Ri, the surrounding syllables Om Mani Padme Hum. Sustaining the sense of your own identity as Avalokiteshvara. And simply holding that, resting there, with a sense of ease, stillness, and clarity. There's one possibility. And there's a second one that's simpler. Narrow the focus of your attention just the lotus and moon disc at your heart, in the center of which is just a pearl of light, a bindu, shimmering white in color. And hold just that in the space of your mind, with a sense of ease, stillness, and clarity. If you choose the latter option, when you begin the practice, you may have a sense as if you're looking down upon this moon disk and the bindu in the center, as if you're in a helicopter hovering above it. But as you relax more deeply into the practice, you may find that you can so relax, so release all grasping, that the locus of your awareness, the place of your awareness, the vantage point of your awareness, descends to your heart, descends to the orb of light at your heart. Becomes that orb of light at your heart upon the moon disk. And rest there in this luminous embodiment of the clear light nature of your own mind. And let's continue practicing now in silence. Voilà. So before we turn to the text and get back to the hard work of shamatha, let's linger just a little bit with language. Because our European languages are very different from Tibetan. And our Judeo-Christian, Greco-Roman worldview is very different from the Buddhist. And sometimes the differences are not all that clear unless you know at least one language on both sides. Yeah? And so just for example, there's a term gyuntul in Tibetan. A lot of translators, good translators, translate it as magical illusions, gyuntul, magical illusions. Right? And then there's the dzuntul, very closely related. Zundukitop, the power of miraculous activity. Miraculous. Zuntul. So magical and miraculous. Okay? These are common translations. I don't like either one of them. Because it's bringing, I think, too much Western baggage into Buddhism that just doesn't... It's not Western, so we shouldn't bring our stuff in unless we're really sure it fits. The notion of magic... Well, when I think of magic, I think of David Copperfield, I think of sleight of hand, I think of mirrors and, you know, cool ways of tricking people into thinking something's true that's not. It's just magic after all. But there is no magic. Everybody who's sensible knows there's no magic, you know. And so then to say these, in Buddhism, we have magic, then I said, oh, you got really good David Copperfields, you know. So I don't agree with that, but even the notion, it's there on the third stage of Mahayana path of accumulation, you remember? Zundukitop, power of miraculous activity, right? But where is this miraculous coming from? It's a Christian term. There's nothing wrong with Christian terms, but they're not Buddhist terms. In the Christian or the Abrahamic context, there's a very clear sense of what is natural and what's supernatural. God created the natural, and God is supernatural. That's it. What was created during those 6 days, that's the natural world. But then scientists who were Christian, like Newton and so forth, tried to understand the laws that God imposed, very Jewish notion of laws that God imposed, but these are not moral laws like the Ten Commandments, but they're rather laws of physics, but they're also laws that God superimposed upon his creation. And then, as I mentioned, and I'm not going to elaborate, it's awfully interesting, but not right now, how these early pioneers of in the 17th century, it was really Newton and his generation, late 17th century, all of them devout Christians, all of them taking quite a literal view of the Bible, all of it, 7,000 years ago, and so forth, because the modern geology, that didn't start happening until the early 19th century, 1830s or so forth, that they found, wait a minute, we're dealing with millions of years here, let alone 5 billion. You know, so none of that was being challenged yet. And so they clearly had something of a dilemma. Well, we're not going to explore that right now. But something was either natural or supernatural. When the Roman Catholic Church looks to assess whether a person is a saint, they're looking, has this person performed two or more miracles, right? Miracles, which means this person was so pure, this person could be a conduit for the divine supernatural activity of God who comes in and basically breaks rules. But they're his own rules, so he can break them as he likes, you know, and not too commonly, so the scientists don't freak out, you know. But that whole notion of some supernatural being out there creating here and then creating us within it, it's just nowhere to be found in Buddhism. So there's a term that, there are two terms, jikten and jikten le depa, they're very common. Laukika, and I can't remember the other one, it doesn't matter. But mundane and supramundane. There are two types of vipassana, right? Two passive vipassana. The mundane, well, wait a minute, just put on your seatbelt. The mundane is going from the desire realm, completely transversing the form realm, completely transversing the formless realm. That's all mundane. But these are going into incredibly subtle dimensions of reality way beyond anything known to modern science, but still called mundane, right? And they're certainly natural. There isn't really a word for natural as in, you know, in the Western sense of the term. But then we have jikten le depa, the path, the supramundane, path of vipassana. And this, of course, is that which is going beyond the mundane world of samsara, the mundane samsara being equivalent to going to nirvana, which is the unborn, the unceasing, the timeless, that which utterly transcends this world of phenomenal appearances, you know. And so that distinction is made, but you see, it's not the same as natural and supernatural. Not really the same at all, especially if we go into, you know, the last 150 years since Thomas H. Huxley started his Church Scientific with the aspiration to go for world domination and to crush all other religions. Marx picked up on that. Union of church and state, well, they really succeeded to a large extent. But in this view, very briefly, it goes back to Thomas Huxley, and then it's emphatic with John Watson, you remember? Subjective experiences don't exist at all. Why? Because they have no physical attributes. You remember that one? And when it's obvious the mind is influencing something, as in the placebo effect, well, you just deny it. You just go into literal psychological denial. This is a pathological situation. It's a pathological condition. You've just seen something that completely torpedoes your basic worldview, that everything boils down to the physical, and you just go into denial. It's like, no, I don't have cancer. If you have cancer, oh, I don't have cancer. I don't have cancer. I have lollipops. You know, it's not a mental event. It's not a mental effect. It's a placebo effect. It's a lollipop effect. And so John Searle, who's really one of the most astute philosophers of mind, writing today, he said, you know, it was very interesting, since he is himself a very committed materialist. He said, you know, what happened in the 20th century is the materialists were faced with a quandary. With God, is he going to blow him off? Of course, God doesn't exist. Angels and all of it, heaven, hell, six realms, if you want to be able to, you know, into the trash can, you know, dump, 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 dump. So get rid of all those things. That's no problem. But then you've got this little mind, which you can't measure physically. And yet all of your science is being done with it. That's kind of awkward. I really wonder what John Watson was thinking when he said, I don't have a mind. Whether he thought of it internally first, and he never even thought it at all. He just heard himself say it. But of course, he didn't really hear himself say it, because that would have entailed consciousness, and consciousness doesn't exist. So I guess he's just talking in the dark and not hearing himself. It's hard to imagine what's going through their minds when they say something like this. But to cut right through it, what they've done here, and now it's a commonplace, it's really all over the media. This is not some weird cult off in a corner of Montana or Texas. They've equated the natural with the physical. They like to call themselves, we are advocating naturalism. And I've spoken with some really smart ones, and I say, when you say you're advocating naturalism, what are you refuting? Supernaturalism. Okay. But what about the mind? And what John Searle said is, the advocates of materialism who are embracing this as their creed, I mean, this is what they live by, just like fundamentalist Christians, fundamentalist Buddhists, Hindus, or anything else. As John Searle said, he said, this is what they did. They found that mind, and that's the whole array of subjective experience, and not just some little mind, it's the whole array of subjective experience, all of it. They first wanted to say it doesn't exist because it's not physically measurable, has no physical attributes, just doesn't make any sense, cannot be embedded in a materialistic framework because it has no physical attributes and can't be measured physically. So then the first ploy was, it doesn't exist at all. But you know, a few decades go by, and then the sheer insanity of that position dawns on people. And so by the 70s and 80s, then they did the other thing. They said, well, that was kind of silly. I hope nobody heard us. Subjective experience does exist because it's equivalent to the brain. So they either throw it out entirely or they equate it with the brain without any justification for either one. Both of them are completely without any compelling evidence or reasoning. But if you're committed to everything being physical and that's all there is to reality, you get dumb and dumber. And those are your two options. Literally. And so the supernatural literally is anything that is not physical, such as the placebo effect. Just don't let on that it's not a placebo effect, because the people might start believing in the supernatural. you know, like your thoughts and emotions, your desires and faith and so forth, actually have some efficacy. So, but let's go to Mahamudra. Okay, I just finished with the West. It's so silly, there's not much worth talking about anymore. And we just hope we grow out of it quickly. The Datura, you know, you take it, hopefully it fades out after a while. If it's, don't keep on taking more and more and more, which is what the media is feeding us every single day. More Datura. I think you might be sleeping a little bit. Have another teaspoon, it's good for you. Rigpa. Pristine awareness. What are we going to do with that? Pristine awareness. It's in the fourth time. It's beyond the matrix. It's beyond the matrix. It is. It is beyond the matrix of causality. It's not within time. It's not within causality. It's not within this world of dependent origination. It's para para. Para para para. Gate gate. Para gate. Para samgate. Bodhisvaha. It's totally beyond. Right? This rigpa. This pristine awareness, it's totally beyond. And so if we consider now from the Buddhist worldview, we'll leave this silliness of the 20th century behind and go into this where, of course, thoughts are natural. Like, duh, you know. And thoughts and information and appearances and emotions and perceptions and consciousness, these are all as natural as footballs, crocodiles, and thumbtacks. That was just a little sampling, you know. But none of these are more real, none of these are more natural than anything else. I mean, it's completely stupid, really. What else can we call it? To say that some thought is supernatural, whereas a thumbtack is real. I mean, it's so silly. So no, they're all equally, and there's physical, there's mental, there's a wide variety of other phenomena within this matrix of dependent origination. But then we have Rigpa. We have Rigpa. And we do have, from the Buddhist perspective, we do have these appearances of Tara manifesting and what look a lot like miracles taking place. And the Christians see them. My own teacher, who for me is Tara, Sakyadamala, she said unequivocally, the mother of Jesus, she's an emanation of Tara. What else would she be? No. So really universal. Tara is not sectarian. Like I only hang out with Buddhists and Mahayana Buddhists and preferably Tibetan. She's not like that. So Tara manifests in the Hindu tradition, the Christian tradition, Mahayana, and so forth and so on. And where she manifests sometimes from this feminine, compassionate manifestation of Rigpa, blessings flow that cannot be understood within the context of the matrix. Because they're not coming from the context of the matrix, they're coming from, stemming from, Buddha nature manifesting as Tara, right? Tara, Manjushri, Avalokiteshvara, the teachings and the parting from the four attachments that Sachin Kung and Yingbo received from Manjushri. That's not coming from within. That's okay, if we're going to call this matrix of dependent origination, we're going to call that nature, then this is supernatural. Sachin Kung and Yingbo was receiving a revelation from Manjushri. Dujum Lingpo was receiving a revelation from Padmasambhava, right? So supernatural, something outside of just the context of causality. But at least it's sane, and that is causality equally includes the mental, the physical, the causal efficacy of information, the causal efficacy of beauty. Beauty has no physical mass. Of justice. Justice has clout, doesn't it? When justice manifests, it has effects. When injustice takes place, doesn't it piss you off? That's because injustice has causal efficacy, has no matter to it, has no mass, spin, charge, location, and so forth. So, you know, we're just kind of come to our senses now after the 150 years of Datura-induced myopia from materialism. So, okay, the natural world is very expansive, myriad of causal influences. And then there's that domain that is inconceivable, that literally transcends all conceptual elaborations. Oh, tupita getandarwa. It is free of it, transcends all the conceptual framework of the eight conceptual elaborations of existence and non-existence, coming and going, birth and cessation, and unity and diversity, unity and multiplicity. These are the categories that we work with, that we make sense of the world. We ask, does it exist or not? Is it stationary? Is it moving? Is it born? Did it die? Is it one or is it many? These are very good questions. And they can be answered within the context of conceptual elaborations, within the context of the natural world of dependent origination, they can be answered. But if you try to ask those questions, if you try to throw that football into the field of pristine awareness, the football vanishes. There's no answer. Because it transcends that. So it's a bit different, isn't it? It's a bit different. The notion of natural in Buddhism is much, much larger than the 20th century's materialistic notion. The notion of supernatural. But the final point there is. Final point, yeah. That is, when we're operating, when our perspective is that of a sentient being, right? And this includes the whole causal sequences of actions and their consequences. Karma, cause and effect. That's all within. It's all natural. There's nothing mystical about it, or esoteric, or occult. It's, come on, get a grip. It's just consciousness interfacing with the material world. I mean, it's been always doing this. What are you getting so excited about, thinking this is religious? Get a grip. It's consciousness has efficacy in the natural world. You know, how did you lose track of that? Come on, wake up. So from this perspective, then, there are many things that make sense. The so-called miracles of modern medicine, it's just wonderful technology. Brilliant science, that's what it is. And they like to use the word miracle because it's really super cool, right? But then on occasion, you know, John of God does something, or Yangtan Rinpoche does something. Friends of mine saw him do something and just say, whoa, that's not possible. Or what I saw, I've seen that three different occasions. But what I saw, a man putting a stone into his mouth, and then it's coming out, and it's 2,000 degrees. I saw that. I felt that. I have 5 scars to prove it. Into his mouth, it comes out, it's 1 to 2,000 degrees, and it burns the flesh like a hot glowing coal. Okay? I saw that. And then when it cools off, he puts it back into his mouth to recharge it. And then it's super hot again. And then, just out of fun, because he's very playful, he shows his tongue. It's the happiest tongue I've seen in my life. It's pink. It's just kind of glowing. Look, I won't show you mine. Mine's disgusting. But he had just this pinkest, happiest tongue. And he keeps on recharging the stone as he heals one person after another, burning holes in their flesh. It's wrathful Padmasambhava approach. I've seen that, you know. But that's just, you know, that's a thimbleful of the kind of things that have been occurring in Buddhist world, sometimes in Christian world, and so forth and so on. So we see, there are these moments of divine intervention, Padmasambhava intervening, the power of the blessings of Padmasambhava, of Tara, Avalokiteshvara, and so forth. And there's so many stories. Oh, story of Fearless in Tibet, wonderful book. The biography, written by a Westerner, very good work. The biography, Lerap Lingba, amazing. And you see some of the things he did, witnessed by many, many people. Incredible. You say, that's supernatural. We're not going to understand that within the matrix of karma and cause and effect and so forth. No, that's something coming in from another place. Tukur Orgyen Rinpoche's biography. What was it entitled? Do you remember? It's a wonderful book. What's that? Blazing Splendor. Oh, that's an amazing one. He talks not only about his own experiences, but things he witnessed in Tibet. Well, either these people are all to get us because it's a conspiracy to trick us to believing into something outside of materialism, or they're just living in a much bigger world than we are. That is, people, you know, locked into kind of a very small worldview of only science being real. And so we can see it. Whoa, that was amazing. Oh, that was amazing. Oh, that was normal. That was amazing. Oh, that's normal. Beep. Like that, you know. So from a mundane perspective, we kind of have these spikes of unusual things. And then we get a saint here and a mahasiddha there and so forth and so on, right? But of course, if you're really viewing all of this from the perspective of pristine awareness, it's all equally displays of pristine awareness. The whole universe is an ongoing miracle from that perspective. That's interesting. Okay. So now we go to one of those Mahasiddhas. It's on page 78. And so the essential instructions of the Mahasiddha Maitripa, he was a guru of Maripa. Together with Naropa, he also learned Mahamudra by Maitripa. So a great Indian Mahasiddha. And here is his presentation of shamatha in a nutshell. There are three types of shamatha. Shamatha that depends on signs, that's a target, some object of the mind. Shamatha focus on conceptualization, just thoughts arising, and then shamatha that is settled in non-conceptualization. That's nice, okay, we have three categories. You see, this is again a whole bouquet, it's a whole array, a lot of variety to choose from here. So first of all, that which depends on signs. In the first, there are two types. Maintaining the attention outwards, so looking at signs or targets, object of the mind, outwards. And then secondly, maintaining the attention inwards. Okay, all very straightforward. Okay, so now looking outwards, there's impure and pure. Okay, everything now, alles in Ordnung, everything nice in its category. So clear. So what we're going to do now is we're going to look outwards. And so for outwards, impure, with the posture endowed with the seven attributes of Arochana, adopt the gaze. Maintain your attention without distraction upon a pillar, a pot, a stick, or a pebble, etc. And that means it could be a cell phone, it could be a radio, a dirty sock, whatever you like, together with the posture and the gaze. In other words, there you are. Do this without indulging in distraction elsewhere and without the dispersion of conceptualization. In other words, don't let the thought just, you know, run away with you. While so doing, settle in relaxation. There's the Mahasiddha, the Mahamudra master speaking. While so doing, settle in relaxation. Moreover, if laxity or excitation arises, recognize whether the attention is being maintained above, below, to the right, or to the left. So if your laxity literally means to sink. So if you find that you're kind of fading out, you're sinking, then recognize that. On the other hand, if some thought kind of drags your attention off, we'll see what direction did it go. Did it go to the left, to the right, up, down? Where did it go? So there's something really simple. This is the coarsest entry level, a mode of shamatha practice. You're going outwards, which is generally more coarser than going inwards, and you're looking at something impure rather than something pure. So very nice. This is elementary school. This is preschool. Good. A lot of people are in preschool. So that's the impure type. But now how about the pure type? In the pure type, maintain the attention upon the jina's body. The jina in Sanskrit means the victorious one, one who has gained conquest or victory over the two types of obscurations. So, a Buddha. Maintain the attention upon the Buddha's body. In other words, you're visualizing a Buddha. But now specifically, in front of you place an image of Lord Amitabha. Or if you do not have one, bear in mind, he's talking to Tibetan peasants, nomads, monks, nuns. They may not have enough to have even a tsatsa, even a clay tablet. They may not be able to afford or have access to any physical image of Amitabha. So don't worry. You can certainly find one. When there were 6,000 monasteries all over Tibet, you didn't have to walk very far to find a monastery where you could certainly find an image of Amitabha. Okay, so find one. If you don't have one, imagine it. Do not let thoughts proliferate away from it or indulge in distractions. While so doing, settle the mind while relaxing. Again, that's Mahamudra coming through. While relaxing in simple non-distraction, this is maintaining the attention upon the pure body of the jina. Years ago, when I was receiving teachings from Tsenshap Sekhon Rinpoche, he's a great scholar, an adept, incredibly lovely human being. He was a secondary kind of tutor or consultant for His Holiness Dalai Lama. He was speaking about a certain tantric practice with his mandala and so forth. And he said, you know, it's very easy to think that you have to generate this whole mandala, that you have to create it out of nothing, you know, out of scratch, out of nothing at all, just, okay, try hard. He said, that's not really true. In fact, that mandala is already there. You just have to see it. And so from his perspective, he would simply discover the mandala and then attend to that which was just naturally appearing to his awareness rather than generate it. And so that's really the user-friendliest way to approach this technique, which Tsongkhapa teaches just definitively in his Lamrims. I've translated one of them and was actually the Goan translator for the other one. in his medium Lamrim, I translated all of it in the book Balancing the Mind, and then I was one of a whole team of people translating the Lamrim Chimo, the great exposition. And so two of us, because it's so much, two of us then translated there his presentation of Shamatha. It's just simply superb. And the method that he focuses on is this one. Yeah? But the most user-friendly way to approach it is kind of playfully, because otherwise this has looked like an awful lot of hard work and grinds you down. You know, it's so hard, so frustrating, so I can't do it. If you can just kind of playfully enter into it, well, I'm sure it's there. Let's just see if I can see it, you know, and just let it come up, and then as it comes up, I'm quite sure it's Kamala Shila says, when the image comes up, then fix on it. But once you've fixed on it, then loosen up. In other words, don't hold onto it with all your mental might. Let it come up, fix on it. That is, tie your mind to that visualized object with a rope of mindfulness. And once you've fastened your attention to it, then loosen up a bit. So you're holding onto it, but gently. Like a mother just walking in a very serene and safe place with her child. And just holding the child as they're just walking along. And it's totally safe. And the mother just gently holds the child, the hand, right? Just more like liking to be in touch rather than controlling the child or protect. Just kind of keeping in touch. Just the soft touch. Hold it just enough that you're not losing it. That way you don't wipe yourself out. You're looking at a skillful technique, that's a skillful technique. So that's a pure type. In terms of maintaining, so that was looking outwards. Then in terms of maintaining the attention inwardly, there are two types, impure and pure. So let's read on a little bit more. You have to keep you busy for the next day. So, you know, so you can do this tomorrow. So in terms of, impure. So maintaining the attention upon an impure bindu. See if this rings a bell. Maintain your attention on a white bindu about the size of a pea, emanating rays of light upon a lotus and moon disc at your heart. Do not let thoughts proliferate away from it or indulge in distractions. These are practical instructions on transforming ideation or just thoughts into the path without abandoning it. So in other words, you are using conceptualization. Your conceptualization, your thoughts are crystallizing in the form of this visualized image, and you're using the power of concepts to proceed on the path of shamatha. Shamatha, that is of the nature of the spiritual path, transforms thoughts into the path. And attention is maintained by focusing on the thoughts of the path. Well, that is, again, this crystallized thought of the visualization. These are the practical instructions. So he presents this as impure, and that's where you don't do what we did. In other words, when he says impure, then it's not in the context of stage regeneration. It's just your ordinary body. So just, do this. At your heart, visualize a lotus, a moon disc, and a white bindu, and just do that. Go for it. Then it's impure vision. Now, in contrast to that, if you do what we did, dissolving everything in emptiness, out of emptiness, then generating the pure vision, the divine pride, and all of that, within the context of that, visualizing the lotus, the moon, and the bindu, then it's a pure. Then it's pure. But you see, you need a lot more. There are many more prerequisites for that one. You should have some insight into emptiness, the bodhicitta, and so forth and so on. Whereas without any understanding of emptiness, or bodhicitta, or belief in Buddha nature, anybody can, you know, if you can visualize, then go ahead. Visualize the bindu at your heart. Then it's impure. Okay? So let me read a little bit more. So, and then two. Okay, now we're focusing inwards and now on pure, a pure object. Maintaining the attention on the pure body of the jina, maintain your attention on Avalokiteshvara, upon a lotus and moon disc at your heart. Okay, now it's pure vision, but still at the heart, inwardly. Avalokiteshvara, upon a lotus and moon disc at your heart, so now instead of simply a bindu, his body the size of the outer thumb joint, so the final joint, the one where the fingernail is, and radiant with light. Do not let thoughts disperse away from it or indulge in distractions. In other words, just stop doing that. You know, don't do that anymore. And if laxity or excitation arises for both the impure and pure methods, maintain the attention by meditating on the forehead or the navel. Okay, tiny bit of commentary there. I think you've probably figured it out already. And that is, if laxity arises, and bear in mind the Tibetan term for laxity literally means to sink. But we all know what laxity is. Laxity, to explain it, laxity is a loss of clarity. The other term, mukpa, dullness, means that not only a lack of clarity, you're dull. Okay, it's a coarser term, it's a thicker term. So you don't have to meditate to experience dullness. We've all experienced that. But laxity, chingwa, this is not a vernacular or a colloquial term. This is a term when you're really meditating and you do have on occasion a real clarity, and then you don't. Before you say, oh, my mind is dull. No, it's just not as clear as it was. So there's dull, everybody knows that, and then there's clear, and then the clarity's gone or it's diminished. That's laxity. And so the laxity literally means sinking. And so if you find that you're sinking into laxity, then elevate the focus of your attention. Instead of focusing in your heart, come up to the forehead. Just, oh, this is an old kind of trick, you know. If laxity, elevate the focus, bring it up. So bring it up here to the forehead, and that'll wake you up. And so up to your forehead, up to the chakra there between the eyebrows. On the other hand, if it's excitation, and excitation literally means wild, gupa, like a wild dog is a wild horse. Your attention is wild, it's running all over the place. Then the old maxim from generations upon generations of yogis is, oh, better than now to focus downwards, ground, focus downwards. So come from your heart down to your navel. Visualize it down there, ground it. So that is shamatha that is dependent on signs. Let's finish what he has to say here. So let's just go back to the framework. Tibetans will often memorize the sapje, the framework. So what do we have there? We have dependent on signs, and then quiescence focus on conceptualization. That's the second one. We've just finished quiescence focus on signs, okay, with all the subcategories. Now we go to shamatha, focus on conceptualization, and then we'll have shamatha focus that is settled in non-conceptualization. These should strike you as quite familiar. Okay, and these two are very, very strongly emphasized in these final two. Whereas the preceding, with the visualizations, these are really, really good preparation for people who are anticipating venturing out on the path of the stage of generation and completion, which entails one heck of a lot of visualization. So you might want to develop those skill sets before you go into these sometimes very complex visualization of a deity with many, many arms and legs, or a big mandala, and then surrounding, and he's like, wow. You know, if you've not even developed your visualization abilities for a single, like a bindu, and then be thrown into the complexity of a mandala, that can just be totally overwhelming. So this is why Tsongkhapa and kind of all the others from all schools, they teach shamatha in the Sutrayana context. You know, I mean, get some basic skill set before you try to bring it into the big leagues, where it's so much more demanding. Emptiness, bodhicitta, divine pride, pure vision, I mean, that's a lot. So let's not kid ourselves, you know. Find the shoes that fit. So if you're really intent on, if you're drawn to any of the practice, the deity yoga, that's what it's called, deity yoga, stage of generation completion, then it will serve you very well to develop your visualization skills. And you might want to start with a pebble, and then a visualized pebble. Or when Geshe Rapten was teaching this way back in 76 in Switzerland, I remember it so clearly. He said, you know, when you're just starting, choose an object that's really familiar to you, that that's just really ordinary, you're extremely familiar with. He said, like my nose. You know, because we spent a lot of time with him. We knew he had kind of a little bit big nose, you know, so. It's as good as any, you know. It can be anything. It can be your cell phone. Generally, it'd be good if it's not something that arouses craving and attachment or hostility and aggression. So if you want to follow that track, visualization really is an extremely good preparation. You're going to need it. Why not develop it in Sutrayana before jumping into the deep end of the pool of Vajrayana? But if, and these are not mutually exclusive, but if your passion, your inclination, your heart's desire is to be looking more in the direction of Mahamudra and Dzogchen, And of course you can do both. Then you would probably want to take a long look at these practices here, coming up here, with mindfulness breathing in the background of both, right? For those people who have a lot of rumination going on, like everybody living today, you know, the mindfulness of breathing, good preparation. But from that, you might want to go the visualization route. If you want to go follow deity yoga, if you're really focusing primarily on Mahamudra Dzogchen, then these two, and then we'll wrap it up for the evening and for the week. Shamatha, in which the attention is focused on conceptualization. Okay, this is simply now one more term. We have a lot of terms. Settling the mind in its natural state, shamatha, focus on the mind. Taking the impure mind is the path, taking appearances and awareness is a path. They're all referring to exactly the same practice. And there's no sectarianism here. There's just no difference at all among all four traditions, and all four traditions practice it. But he's saying, okay, you're focusing on thoughts. You know that. We've done it already. In relation to the excessive proliferation of conceptualization, just thoughts coming up, including such afflictions as the five poisons, craving, hostility, delusion, and then pride and envy, or the three poisons, those you know. So in relation to the excessive proliferation of conceptualization, including these toxins of the mind, thoughts that revolve in duality, just any kind of dualistic grasping, thoughts such as those of the 10 virtues, the 6 perfections, the 10 virtues being the opposite of the 10 non-virtues, not killing and so forth, the 6 perfections or the 10 perfections, in other words, very virtuous thoughts may come up. Whatever is coming up, toxic, afflictive thoughts or virtuous, benevolent thoughts, whatever is coming up, whatever virtuous and non-virtuous thoughts arise, steadily and non-conceptually observe their nature. There's the key right there. So clear. Don't get enmeshed in the conceptualization from a non-conceptual perspective. Observe the thoughts rather than cognitively fusing with the thoughts, which makes your mind conceptual, makes your awareness conceptual. But you can observe thoughts from a non-conceptual perspective. You can observe concepts from a non-conceptual perspective. And that's our unflickering candle flame. Should be very familiar now. So we're seeing, he's saying the same thing. That should be reaffirming. That all I've been teaching was not just something that some California hippie dreamed up all by myself. You know, that should be very reassuring for you. So by so doing, they are calmed by simply attending to them and not revving them up by grasping onto them, hoping, fearing, desiring, and so forth. That by so doing, they are calmed in non-grasping. There it is. He's using very few words. Awareness vividly arises, clear and empty, with no object of grasping, okay? In other words, the field has gone empty, you're left with a substrate, no object of grasping, a sheer vacuity, and it is sustained in the nature of self-liberation in which it recognizes itself. Wow, did he pack in so much in one sentence. By so doing, they're calmed and non-grasping, so all the thoughts subside, you're left only with the substrate. Awareness vividly arises, clear and empty, your own substrate consciousness arising, translucent, luminous, grasping onto nothing, and it is sustained in the nature of self-liberation, and that is whatever thoughts come up, they just release themselves. And your awareness recognizes itself. That's one of the densest sentences I've ever seen. He packs so much into that. Again, direct the mind to whatever thoughts arise, and without acceptance or rejection, that is, without latching onto or pushing away, you will recognize your own nature. Oh. In other words, he suggested here, you might even realize Rigpa, or at least the conventional nature of consciousness. Thus, implement the practical instructions on transforming ideation into the path. So you're attending to ideation, and then the ideation takes you right beyond ideation. Very clever. And you can see it's just a different phrasing from Dujum Lingba's terminology, taking the impure mind as the path, which takes you beyond the impure mind into the substrate consciousness, which is by nature pure, relatively pure, free of the five obscurations. That's wonderful. So there's one, and then you should know what's coming up. And now see also the term he uses. This is the term Buddha Shakyamuni used when he spoke of Shamatha focused on consciousness itself. He said, this is the highest. Here's my Mahasiddha Maitreya saying the same thing. It's Padmasambhava saying the same thing. After he goes a whole sequence, he comes to finally shamatha without a sign. All the other ones have signs, they have a target. You're attending to something. Now retract the tentacle, the rope of your attention. Psh, stay home. The ultimate shamatha of maintaining the attention upon non-conceptualization. Again, the different phrasing is interesting. Non-conceptual. He doesn't say awareness of awareness. He said sustained attention upon non-conceptualization with the body possessing the seven attributes of arochana. Sit upon a soft cushion in a solitary darkened room. Or if you don't have a darkened room, wait until the 20th century and for only $20 Australian you can buy a mindfold. Wow! He saw that coming. Amazing, isn't it? Right? Okay. But there we have it. For $20, thanks to Rhonda. You're sitting in a darkened room even if you're out in the sunlight. Very cool. Unless you have a very broad head. Then, cotton. Think cotton, you know. Okay, so, but let's move on here. Vacantly direct the eyes into intervening vacuity, just the space in front of you. See that the three conceptualizations, that is, thoughts pertaining to the past, future, and present, as well as virtuous, non-virtuous, and ethically neutral thoughts, together with all the causes, assembly, and dispersal of thoughts of the three times, are completely cut off. So just tell your mind, mind, listen up. Shut up! As a simple negation. Just shut up! And it is, but shut up! Or you can say, shut up! Or you can say, shut up! But just shut up! Tsongkhapa speaks about a thought that's about to emerge. Is it clear? So, completely cut off. Bring no thoughts to mind. Let the mind, like a cloudless sky, be clear, empty, and evenly devoid of grasping, and settle it in utter vacuity. Now, what you're not doing is passing out, spacing out, going into oblivion. Then you are literally cultivating stupor. And you know what happens then. You become stupid. So you eliminate all thoughts, but you don't hit yourself on the hammer with a, you know, with a big hammer. You don't go, you know, and go unconscious. You obliterate all thoughts and maintain the flow of cognizance. Non-conceptual cognizance. That's the one man standing, the one woman standing, gender neutral. That's what's standing. Knock out all thoughts, and there's still this. And sustain that, and that alone. So it's a complex negation. It is simply the release, the negation, the cessation of all thoughts, and then what's left over. Ah. But the trajectory there is just simple negation. Because you can't just, I'm going to go unconscious. You can't do that. I mean, you can take a drug, you can hit yourself, but no, with meditative, you can't just stop being conscious. It's not an option. But you can terminate thoughts, and what's remaining is just awareness, cognizance, rikpa. So, by so doing, you will experience the shamatha of bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality. That's what remains when your mind collapses into the substrate consciousness. You'd make this discovery. Examine whether or not attachment, hatred, clinging, grasping, laxity, or excitation enter into that, and recognize the difference between virtues and vices. So recognize the obstacles along the way, and just keep it simple. So that's his technique. More could be said, but not right now. That should keep you definitely busy for a day and a half. So enjoy. I think one of you mentioned, couldn't we have 2 days off per week? I get it. I'm tempted myself. But for the time being, we'll stick with one. But enjoy. Got plenty to work with. So, see you around.